and Brother Bob. I'd like to once again call upon our brother Mark Vincent to bring unto us our second class this afternoon, entitled The Meaning of Death. Brother Mark.
So we've looked at the frame and we've seen how the editor points us in a direction and says, this is the lesson, this is the conclusion that you should draw from the words of the preacher. And now for the remaining talks, we're going to go inside that frame to the words and the observations of the preacher and to see what he observes about the human condition, human life and experience. So, just an orientation for this talk. We're gonna spend a good few minutes in chapter 1, then we're going to have a quick look at a couple of other verses about death in chapter 3 and chapter 9, and then we're going to go into chapter 12 again. And what one of the things we're going to see is that death is a key theme at the beginning of the book and at the end of the book, you know, inside that frame of vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So let's start with verse 3. Then, what's the very first thing that the preacher points out as he begins to instruct? What profit hath a man of all his labour which he taketh under the sun? And that's a rhetorical question, but we know what the implicit answer is to that. Not much at the best, isn't it? And a few of the key terms of the book are introduced already in that verse. We're not going to explore these now. They'll probably come out in later talks. But the term profit there, what profit is there? The term labour, the idea of things under the sun. We'll come back to those. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abides forever. And so do you see the contrast there that he's setting up? He's setting a contrast between man. One generation comes, another and goes, another generation comes and goes, another generation comes and goes, but the earth abides forever. And the earth, with its permanence, by its very eternity, by its very substance, mocks the transience of man. The fleeting show of his life. There's no profit to his labour. There's nothing that remains when he's gone. These are some of the points that later verses will unpack in much more detail. One generation comes and another generation goes. And the earth is just there, where God put it, on and on and on. And we thought we were so smart and so clever. And we thought that we were the centre of the world, didn't we, in our own little worlds. But this generation has come, and were the Lord to not return, would go, like all the generations that have preceded it. And what will happen to our little world that seemed so big in that day? It'll be gone. And the earth will still be there. And that speaks both to the power and the eternity of God and to our own insignificance. It's quite a powerful, and he gets to the heart of the issue pretty soon, doesn't he, after having said vanity of vanities, all is vanity. This is effectively the first thing that he turns to. Just how fleeting, how breath-like, how vain our existence is. Just like a puff of breath that is there one minute, but you can never get hold of it and say, right, I'm going to keep that forever, because it's gone. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south, and turneth about to the north. It whirleth around continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, and yet the sea is not full. So he goes through some cycles then that we're familiar with. the water cycle. And, you know, you remember doing those drawings of the water cycle in science at school. And the orbits, the planetary orbits. And the wind whirling around continually. And the cycle of human existence. One generation passeth, and another generation cometh and passeth, cometh and passeth. And they're all cycles, and yet, of course, they're not, are they? Because the human cycle is different to the others. And remember this point being made very powerfully in a talk by Brother Alfred Norris, and it's always stuck in my mind. This point about you're lulled into thinking, yes, human generations come and go, round and round they go, and yet the sun goes round and round, and the wind goes round and round, and the water cycle goes round and round. But of course it's the same sun that goes round. It's the same sun that will come up tomorrow that came up today. And it's, you know, the wind. It's all kind of one wind, isn't it? And the water cycle, it's a cycle. It rains and then it gets sucked up again and round it goes. But the human generations aren't like that, because there never will be another me or another you. Whereas the sun exists all through those cycles, a human cycle isn't really a cycle at all, because it's so short and will never come again. And so a man in all his pride, in all his show, you know, he, little baby, and the baby gets up and crawls, and then it walks, and then it gets bigger, and then it ends up being full size, and it's so full of pride in what it can do and what it's going to do with its life. And yet we know where it's going, and we know what old age and death, what that means, and how all our pride and arrogance then and show is mocked by that fact. And so there is no progress in all of that, then. There's no progress in the sun going round and round and round, and the wind going round and round, and the water going round and round. There's no progress. And there's even less progress in human beings not even going round and round and round. And so he comes on to say, all the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. And to the place from whence the rivers came, there they return again. All things are full of labour. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. And you can almost appreciate the exhaustion just from watching the sun going round and round and round. Watching all these cycles take place is almost tiring of itself. All things are full of labour. Man cannot utter it. And we've not even got to the activities of man yet, and how meaningless they might be. And how there's no satisfaction, that the eye is never satisfied. It never has enough. Human beings, there's something within us, so that trying to be content is so difficult, isn't it? Because there is this thing to always want to see more, to want more. And that's just like the rivers running into the sea, yet the sea not being full. And so the human eye is not satisfied with seeing. There's no conclusion, there's no satisfaction, there's no fulfillment. And it's a picture really of, you know, us taking a long step back from human beings' busyness and self-importance and saying there's a way in which it's just like watching lemmings, really, watching this happening. And you can see that in a sense he's right. And of course, he's not talking about how things are with a view of God's plan, which is indeed moving forward towards its goal. He's talking about how things are outside of that. And in a way, the frame is more dealing with why that might be important. And then we step inside and see what life is like without that understanding, because the preacher never shows whether he has that understanding or not. It's not quite true, and sometimes you hear it said that it's talking about life without God. preachers talking about life without God. I'm not sure that that's quite true, because it does talk about God quite a lot. The preacher does talk about God quite a lot. But it's certainly about life without the fullness of the knowledge of God's purpose that we have. And of course, if you went into the ancient world and talked about life without God, that would have been a meaningless concept, because there wasn't anybody who didn't believe in God or in gods, with a small g, in the ancient world. And so a skeptic was never going to go into the position of saying, well, this all looks vain and meaningless to me, therefore I don't believe in God. So it's not quite true to say that the preacher is looking at life without God, but he's assuming a kind of very vague notion of God, I think. So yeah, but most people in the world at that time that might have read what he was writing would have believed in God as people did in the ancient world, but would they have a sense of God's ultimate purpose, like the rest of the scriptures have revealed to us? And the answer to that is probably no for most people. And it's that sort of life that the preacher is looking at. So human nature, human life then, is repetitious and derivative, isn't it? The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. The thing that hath been is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done, and there is no new thing under the sun. And you can see that there's a sense in which that is true and is not true, but we just need a little bit of common sense there, don't we? I mean, it's true, obviously, that we have come up with things, technological capacities and capabilities that didn't exist before. So it's, in that sense, it's not true that there is no new thing under the sun. But in terms of what are people like, and what are the sorts of concerns that fill people's hearts, what are the sorts of things that people are worried about, that people strive after, that people fight over, is there any new thing in those things? Are human beings behaving in a fundamentally different way to the way in which they've always behaved in the past? Have they had the opportunity to do so? And the preacher is telling us no. The human beings are what they are, and there is no new thing under the sun, and there is no satisfaction in that life. And he's absolutely right to say that. And of course, there are a whole other set of verses that you could turn to which make a similar point. We'll just take one of those two and verse 12. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do that cometh after the king, even that which hath been already done? So, and that's the sort of challenge that he's throwing out. You know, do you think you can think of something that's more lavish, more clever, more entertaining? I've been there, I've seen it all, and you won't find anything. And that's because he's the king, so he can do anything he wants. And, you know, we're not kings, so we don't know quite what it's like. So his opportunities were immense, and he exploited those, as he tells us in chapter 1 and chapter 2. Whether that was a wise thing to do is not stated, and we can come to our own conclusions about that. But that's what he did. And he saw that everything that he tried, that it wasn't really new after all. It was just another version of the same thing, and that he couldn't, by seeking out some new thing or by seeking out some extra wisdom, he couldn't break outside of that vanity that seemed to be choking his life and his existence. He couldn't crack through it by any endeavour of his own striving. Verse 11, there is no remembrance of former things, neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are to come with those that shall come after. And again, we can say, well, yeah, true and not true. I mean, it is true that we remember who made, you know, who invented the atomic bomb and perhaps who invented the television and so on. So there is some memory in that sense. And yet, in the sense of, do I really care about those people? No, not now, because I'm so obsessed by my own little life that, and you know, we remember our immediate family, but do I remember beyond two generations? Do I remember beyond my own grandparents? Is there any memory of that? No, and the memory of them is small amongst others other than their immediate family. And that's what he's pointing out. And there's a sadness to that, there's a heaviness to it. It's sad to come face to face with the fact that we are so insignificant, isn't it? And that our life is so frail. Well, there's an exhortation then, isn't there, that we shouldn't get carried away by novelty, by thinking of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, but that we should live soberly. That we should see our own significance for what it is, and that we only have any significance because God has chose to look at us in a certain way and has chose to account us righteous. That is what gives us significance. Otherwise, we would just be as these generations that he describes here. So we need to step back then sometimes and to see this big picture of our own insignificance in order to properly frame our lives and in order to properly set a course for ourselves. Let's not think that the things that we're doing in our own little lives are more significant, are more important, are more wise than things that any other generation or any other people amongst us have done or are doing. Let's remember the limits that God has imposed upon human life, which he imposed, of course, right in the very beginning of Genesis. And in a sense, these passages in Ecclesiastes about death and about the vanity of the human condition are a commentary on what Genesis 3 means, aren't they? That's what they are. They open it out, what it meant when God said that that we had to die. Let's go then, and we'll look at this one much more briefly, but let's go to chapter 3. I want to take two other passages about death, one in 3 and one in 9, and then we'll go to 11 and 12 to finish this session. So chapter 3, and verse 19. But that which befalleth the sons of man befalleth beasts, even one thing befalleth them. As the one dieth, so dieth the other. Yea, they have all one breath, so that a man hath no preeminence above a beast. For all is vanity. All go to one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. And you can see there how that clearly is a remodeling of Genesis 3, isn't it, of the curse that was, of the punishment that was originally given to Adam. And the preacher is saying it's true, it's absolutely right. God did what he said he would do, and this now hedges us in. This now constricts us above anything else and makes our existence vain and futile. And the verses about that which befalls man befalls beasts, of course, we use those in lectures, don't we? They're like the words in the Psalms, like sheep, they're laid in the grave. And if we could see ourselves like that a bit more often than we do, perhaps, it might help us, mightn't it, to live our lives more appropriately in God's sight. And we've got hymns about that, which speak to that, haven't we? In death, there is no power to know. Life is the time to serve the Lord. Almighty maker of my frame, short is the measure of my days. Give me to know how frail I am, and spend the remnant to thy praise. A span is all that I can boast, an inch or two of time. Verse 21, of course, is a little one of those little problem passages in quotes, isn't it? Let's just have a quick look at it. Who knoweth the spirit of man that goeth upward and the spirit of the beast that goeth downward to the earth? How are we supposed to interpret that? Well, it's a sort of ironic comment, I think. I mean, he's just told us in the verse before, or two verses before, that a man and a beast go to the same place. So he's not immediately about to contradict him and himself and say, no, actually they don't. The man goes up and the beast goes down, is he? Clearly not. What he's doing is he's saying, and you think something different, do you? Well, how are you going to prove that? Who knows? What evidence have you got for saying that man has some other destination other than from going into the earth like a beast? You have no evidence whatsoever for that claim. It's a useless claim, effectively. Such speculation is entirely unverifiable by humans. So it's a rhetorical question. Let's jump to chapter 9 then. And this is perhaps is the one we use most often in lectures. Verse 2, all things come alike to all. There is one event to the righteous and to the wicked, to the good and to the clean, to the unclean, to him that sacrificeth, to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner, and he that sweareth, as he that feareth an oath. Human beings all die. And there is a tragedy in that, and there's a tragedy in that it has had to be that way because of our sin, doesn't it? And I think that's the point that he's making there. Whatever may be the case about our hope for the future, this remains the case because of what happened in Genesis. Verse 3, this is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all, yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart while they live, and after that they go to the dead. For to him that is joined by to all the living there is hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. I think I think that's great irony, isn't it, there? Just think of what the point of that is. So it's good to be alive because there's hope, but that hope's not specified. For a living dog is better than a dead lion. So yes, it's better to be alive than to be dead, he's saying. But then what he says, for the living know that they shall die, but the dead know not anything. So how is it better to be alive than to be dead? Well, at least if you're alive, you know that you're going to die, whereas if you're dead, you don't actually know that because you don't know anything. So some comfort then, yeah, to be alive and to know that. That makes me feel really good that I know I'm going to die. And I think that's absolutely the irony that's in that passage. And there's the point about the memory again at the end of verse 5. The memory of them is forgotten also. Their love and their hatred and their envy is now perished. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done under the sun. So there is a time then, isn't there? There's a need here that we stop and think and that we reflect on why that is and what our sin means. So that's what it means. That's why we have funerals. Because we didn't do what God said we should do. And now we're subject to this vain existence and death. That is the meaning of death. Let's go then to chapter 12, or 11 and 12. We're coming at 11 and verse 7. Truly the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. So think of light then as an image of life there. And it's good to be alive. What a beautiful day it is, and how nice it is just to go outside and take a few steps and just to sort of breathe in. We went for a walk this morning and took the children to a play park, and it was a lovely balmy morning, and you could smell the plants, and the sunlight shone down. And isn't it fantastic then to be alive? And what a wonderful gift that is from God. And the preacher recognises that, not in the passages that we've looked at yet, but the preacher recognises that too. You know, he's not completely one-sided in what he says. We're just trying to face the facts on the negative side right now. And here he's saying the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. But, and there's always a but with what he says, whenever he says something positive, there's always a but. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many. All that cometh is vanity. And he's talking, I think, about the darkness of death and the coming, that coming vanity. So, if God has blessed us with a long and a healthy life, let's make sure we really appreciate what that means and what its alternative is, and thank him for it. Let's remember the days of darkness and the condition that God has imposed upon us, and let's use that life that God has given us to live in the right way with the right attitudes before him. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thy heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But, and here's his second but know that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. So, that's the check for us. That's the yardstick by which we should measure the courses that we're plotting. Therefore, remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. You think you're so smart, so powerful, so strong in your youth. But childhood and youth are a vanity, just like everything else, because they're going to pass away too, and soon your back will be crooked too. Is the sort of point, isn't it? Remove sorrow from thy heart. So don't be, this isn't leading us to a let's slit our wrists then conclusion. Is saying remove sorrow from thy heart and enjoy what God has given you in the life that you have. But let's set that in a context of what overall is the shape of a man or a woman's life and why it indeed has that shape. Because that will help us to live our lives right. Remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth, while the evil days come not. And what he does now then is he now goes into a description of those evil days. And we want to spend our time now from verse 2 through to verse 7 looking at that description of the aging process and of death. Nor the years draw nigh when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. And people do say that, don't they? And I expect we've known people whose health has deteriorated to such a point that they will say things like that. And how sad it is and how painful it is to hear those words, especially if they're spoken by people that we love dearly. I remember a sister saying, a sister who's really seemed quite well and seemed to be having a relatively good life in her own age, in her old age, but she just commented, I just can't taste my food anymore, and I wish I could, and just the thought for me of not being able to taste my food was just isn't it sad that. So how does he describe it then? So the years in which thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them, well, we can understand pretty clearly what he would be talking about there. But let's carry on this picture of deterioration. While the sun or the light or the moon or the stars be not darkened, nor the clouds return after the rain. It's like the light of life is closing in, isn't it? This darkness is coming. This darkness that I knew, I knew that there was darkness and that someday the days of darkness would come and I would approach my death. But now the sky is, as it were, darkening as I'm reading the verses, and I can feel it getting nearer to me, and I can start to understand what death means. And the ominous rain clouds gathering. In the day when the keepers of the house shall tremble, and the strong men shall bow themselves, and the grinders cease because they are few, and those that look out of the window shall be darkened. And I expect you know that you know, a usual way of interpreting this is of different phenomena about the human physique and the human capacities gradually giving up working in the way that they always used to work. And so the keepers of the house, that can be understood as the weakening arms now. You don't have the strength that you used to have. You used to have to be able to pick up something and do some jobs, and now it takes it out of you completely if you do something like that. Or perhaps you can't even do it at all. The trembling of the limbs now. And the strong men shall bow themselves, and that, you know, that they can't stand up so tall anymore as you used to when you were a young man or a young person. The grinders shall cease because they are few, and people have seen in that a reference to the decaying teeth falling out, and you can't eat the foods that you used to. You can't chew a good steak like you might once have enjoyed doing. And those that look out of the windows be darkened, and the deteriorating eyesight now captured in that verse. And the doors shall be shut in the street. Some people relate that to the weakening hearing. And, you know, all that noise and bustle that used to be about in the streets, and gradually it's closing, and you can't quite hear it anymore. And it's as if there's muffling, or as if there's a cushion over all that life, all that vibrance that there once used to be. The sound of the grinding is low. And he shall rise up at the voice of a bird. And some people have seen the sound of the grinding as the weakening voice, and rising up of the voice of the bird as weak sleep, terminated sleep, having to get up in the middle of the night, not being able to sleep like you used to. And all the daughters of music shall be brought low, and that joy that you might once have experienced, and the edge and the brightness has come off that now. And they shall be afraid of that which is high, fear of height, and fear shall be in the way. And the grasshopper shall be a burden, and desire shall fall, because man goeth to his long home. What about the grasshopper? Well, people have taken that to be a description of diminishing sexual appetite, lessening of sexual desire, so that where is the verse again? Let's just read it again. When it says desire shall fail, people understand the desire as being a reference to the caperberry, which was an aphrodisiac, and saying that the aphrodisiac's not working anymore. That would be the point of that. And I think people have taken the almond tree as the whitening hair as well, I think, if I remember correctly. So it's sad, isn't it? It's sad. And this is what eventually comes to people, to human beings. This is where it's going. Without the hope which we have in God, and even with that hope, in the meantime, that's where it's going. And it's still sad. And, you know, we can try and pretend that isn't sad, but it is. What a great piece of literature, isn't it? What a great piece of writing to describe that process. You know, I could have talked about it, but it wouldn't have been anywhere near as powerful as these images that the preacher has used here. But I'd like to ask a question. Let's just look at Let's just look at what he says at the end of verse 5. He says, because man goeth to his long home, or to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. And you get the idea then that we're seeing now beyond the aging process to the point when there will actually be the funeral procession will take place. Verse 6, when the silver cord is loosed and the golden bowl is broken and the pitcher is broken at the fountain and the wheel at the cistern, then shall the dust return to the earth as it was, and the spirit shall return to God who gave it. And here we are right at Genesis 3 again. And that's where the preacher finishes talking. That's the very last words of the preacher. That we've gone right back to Genesis 3 and said, and there you are then, there you have it. Exactly as God said. That's the end. Without the redemption that God offers, that is the end, and that's the best that human beings have to look forward to. And in verse 6, I think he's using two images. He's using the image of a light, a silver cord, holding a golden bowl of light, and at some point the silver cord is slashed and the bowl falls to the ground and smashes and the light is extinguished. Or there's another image of the pitcher at the fountain. So the pitcher that you're going to roll down into the well to bring up the water. And again, water like light is used as a symbol of life in the scriptures. And that cord is going to be cut and there's no more drawing water from that well. And like the life, just as the light is extinguished and the waters of life, using it in a literal, not a spiritual sense, the waters of life are over. They can be drunk no more. So I'd like to finish by thinking about where this language comes from. So what we've done at the moment is we've taken each of the expressions, like the grinders, and said, well, maybe that's the teeth, and maybe the keepers of the arms, and that's what people usually do. But I think that's entirely valid. But I think you can go a little bit further than that, and one writer who wrote about this passage entitled his chapter, When Worlds End. And we've looked at it as in the ending of my world, you know, my life as I would get old and ultimately die. But where do these images come from, the keepers and the grinders and the noise in the streets? Why pick on those particular images? Well, perhaps there's a bigger picture thing taking place here. And perhaps what is being described is actually a funeral procession. What is being described in the whole piece, from verse 2 through to verse 7, is a funeral procession. And on this funeral, it is raining. And the windows are darkened. The windows of the houses are darkened in respect of the dead as the funeral procession passes by. And the men, the workers, the strong men, bow themselves to pay their respects as the procession passes by. And there's the windows being darkened at the end of verse 3. And there's no grinding today because of this funeral procession. And the doors are shut in the street. And there's no music. And at the end of verse 5, then, now it becomes concrete, because a man is going to his long home, and the mourners are going about the streets. And I think there's some mileage in that to see the passage as a description of a funeral procession and what happens in a small village or something when the funeral takes place. And then you say, well, whose funeral is it then? And is it that in a way the preacher is asking you and asking me to watch our own funerals and think about the significance of that? And then the editor comes in and says, fear God and keep his commandments, because that's what you should be doing while you can. And that message now of the editor has an extra power, doesn't it, when set in that context? Certainly does. But there's more to it even than that, I think, in this language that's used in this amazing poem in Ecclesiastes 12. That title that I mentioned, When Worlds End, because I think he's describing it not just the ending of my world and my funeral, but he's describing also the end of the world in a bigger sense. Think of the language of some of the prophets. Think of, you know, there is no music. There's no one in the streets. The windows are dark. There's no sound to be heard. There's no grinding. There's no work taking place today. Everyone is scared because of fear for looking after those things that are going to come upon the earth. And what does the language of the prophets say? Let's just have a really quick look in Jeremiah. We'll just take two passages, Jeremiah and chapter 4. And you'll notice that there are a lot of similarities between this prophetic language and the language of Ecclesiastes 12. So he's not just saying, think about what's going to happen when you die and when I die, but he's saying, think what's going to happen to human society. Think where that's going, because God is bringing that to an end, and that will go to its long home, so that God can establish a new world wherein righteousness dwells. So, how does that help in framing our lives? Well, that's helpful too, isn't it? Let's not be too caught up in this world, knowing that it's passing away. Because it's the same old world, repetitious and derivative, as we saw in chapter 1. Verse 19 of Jeremiah 4. My bowels, I am pained at my very heart. My heart maketh a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace, because thou hast heard, O my soul, the sound of the trumpet, the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is spoiled. Suddenly are my tents spoiled, and my curtains in a moment. How long shall I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? Verse 23, I beheld the earth, and lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. I beheld the mountains, and lo, they trembled, and all the hills moved lightly. I beheld, and lo, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens were fled. And I beheld, and lo, the fruitful place was a wilderness, and all the cities thereof were broken down at thy presence, at the presence of the Lord, and by his fierce anger. For thus saith the Lord, thus hath the Lord said, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end. For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken it, I have purposed it, and will not repent, neither will I turn back from it. Now, we don't have time to unpack those similarities, but hopefully you can recognize in that, you know, Jeremiah is describing a deserted village or city as well, where people are petrified about what is going to happen. And we know that God isn't going to make a full end, but there is an end that he's going to make. And Jeremiah is making us consider that. And let's just have a quick look at Isaiah and chapter 24. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. Verse 3, the land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled. Verse 4, the earth mourneth and fadeth away, the world languisheth and fadeth away, the haughty people of the earth do languish. Verse 6, therefore hath the curse devoured the earth, and they that dwell therein are desolate, because the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The new wine mourneth, the vine languisheth, all the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of tabrets ceaseth, the noise of them that rejoice endeth. The joy of the harp ceaseth, they shall not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down, every house is shut up, that no man may come in. Verse 12, in the city is left desolation, and the gate is smitten with destruction. And so I think that's quite powerful, really, then. So the Ecclesiastes starts with the individual man, and it compares the generations going round and round with the cycles of the earth, with the permanence of the earth, and says, look how short man's days are. And then we come to the end of the book, after a couple of passages in between that are also about the pointlessness and the sadness of death, and come to the end of the book, and we have there a most powerful description, not only of what it's like to get old in a literal way, in which we lose some of our faculties and abilities and enjoyment that we once had, but that also we think about our own funeral procession, and we think about where human society, it ultimately must come to its knees before God, before he can establish a world which is good and which is built and founded upon righteousness. So we'll come on in later talks to thinking about, you know, what's the point, what is the meaning of life, but what the preacher has made us think about first and last in his words is something else, not the meaning of life, but the meaning of death. And he hasn't explicitly told us what the meaning of it is. He said that it's a vanity. And yet he's directed us pretty explicitly to those echoes of Genesis chapter 3. And he's brought us, who have that understanding of God's purpose and of where the world is going, he's brought us to think about what the meaning of death is again. And we know what it is intellectually, but he's brought us perhaps to feel it again, perhaps more acutely than we would have, than would have been possible for us without the book of Ecclesiastes to guide us. He's made us experience it, and he's made us think about why that should be, which leads us to repentance, and he's made us think then about what sort of people we ought to be before God. Not people who sorrow and despair because of this, but people who put sorrow away from their hearts, but people who remember their Creator while they have life, and who give that life to him in service, who fear God and keep his commandments, because that is man's all.